Support for Quality of Life comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Kaiser Permanente, and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.
This is Quality of Life, Valley Public Radio's look at the people and the issues affecting the way we live in the San Joaquin Valley. Here is your host, Joe Moore.
Well, hello and welcome to our program. Nearly 1 year ago, on March 23, 2010, President Obama signed into law the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, a sweeping and often controversial legislation with the aim of expanding health coverage to millions of Americans and reforming many aspects of the health care system. The law is now being challenged by a number of states in the courts. However, for many Valley residents, the bill offers little immediate help, with its biggest provisions not taking effect until 2014. Later in our program, we'll learn more about what interim steps are being taken to implement the new law here in California. But first, we examine the current health care crisis facing many Valley residents. Over the last few years, 700,000 more Californians joined the ranks of the uninsured, bringing the state's total to 7.1 million. In the Central Valley, this health care crisis has been felt especially hard, devastating middle class as well as poor families, and threatening to overwhelm the region's fragile safety net. Across class lines, people are struggling to access care or simply are going without. In a special report produced for Valley Public Radio by the Center for Health Reporting at USC, together with the Modesto Bee, here's Lauren Whaley with the story from Modesto.
Dr. R.J. Heck cuts away the yellow, dead skin from a festering wound on the bottom of Jesus Morales' foot. The 33-year-old Morales has diabetes and no sensation in his left foot. He can't feel the doctor's scissors. Today, he'll hobble off on crutches, but he could face an amputation if he doesn't keep up with his medication.
We get a lot of people in here who have chronic wounds who simply can't afford to go see a regular wound center or a regular doctor.
Heck is co-founder of St. Luke's Family Practice in Modesto. He and his partner see two sets of patients: benefactors who have health insurance but pay up to $1,800 a year extra to see the docs whenever they want, and recipients like Morales and other uninsured folks who pay nothing. St. Luke's is just one clinic answering the call in Stanislaus County, which has more than 90,000 uninsured residents. Dr. R.J. Heck.
Anecdotally, we have seen more people who were professionals or who are professionals and cannot afford to insure themselves anymore.
The county's emergency rooms are seeing more people too, a lot more. Over the past 5 years, local ERs have seen a 64% increase in uninsured patient visits.
Were we supposed to have been saving for a time like this? Should we have been prepared for a time like this? How could we have fallen back more on a cushion?
Laura Hinton used to be a stay-at-home mom. Now at 38, she works 6 nights a week at one waitressing job and 4 days a week at another. Her husband, 49-year-old David, lost his job of 13 years in May 2009 and still hasn't found work. They have 3 kids at home. David Hinton.
Either if you're rich, you have a job, or you have money and it doesn't matter. If you're poor, you get all the government stuff. But if you're in the middle, there's nothing offered. We still don't have insurance. We haven't had insurance in 2 years.
Laura Hinton says she never imagined that she would be in this situation. She remembers thinking,
I'm taking care of what is rightfully my responsibility, my own children, my own family. Okay, outside of that, it's not my responsibility to pay your medical care because you're out of work. You know, she's on the other foot and we're in that place now. It's like, wow, could someone throw us a bone, please? Because we're exhausted. And we did do what we were supposed to do for so long.
Really, these people are the same people that they were 4 months ago, you know, pride-wise. They want to get help. They want to do the right thing.
Across town at Doctors Medical Center, Dr. Eric Ramos can hardly keep count of the numbers of newly uninsured patients he's seeing.
Any pain in here at all? And the stigma of having to go to a clinic that serves the quote-unquote poor is very hard for them.
One of Ramos's patients spends all the money he makes from his painting business to pay for his wife's medical care. He rarely visits the doctor at all.
All right, let's have you lie back.
So basically what I do, I treat him for free, and, you get the medications from the pharmacy reps and call them up and say, hey, I've got your medicine here, and you do whatever you can to make things work.
For Ramos, making things work also means more visits over email and phone to save patients a trip into the office. For others, like 61-year-old Julie Levitt, making things work may mean prioritizing health needs.
As my doctor has said, and as another doctor has said, you pick your battle. What is it that we need to attack first? Is it your diabetes? Is it your depression? Is it your blood pressure? Because we need to pick the things that we can get support for. Osteoporosis? Maybe not on the top of the list.
Levitt lost her Bay Area job and its $53,000 salary in 2009. Her unemployment benefits are too high to qualify for the county health program, but she doesn't make enough to pay for private insurance. She now shares a room in Turlock with a friend's 9-year-old granddaughter. Levitt, she sleeps on the bottom bunk.
I want to get a job, and I want to get my insurance back. I want to have my doctors on call. I want my old life back.
All across the valley, residents who are out of work and uninsured are hoping for the same thing. For Valley Public Radio, this is Lauren Whaley in Modesto.
And you're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. Today we're talking about health care and the crisis in care. Ongoing now, a year after the passage of the Affordable Care Act, we're looking at its impact in the Valley and nationwide in terms of the implementation of this new law. We'd love to hear from you. If you have a story similar to those that we just heard from Modesto and Turlock, we'd love to hear from you. You can call us with your story. The phone number is 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989 if you've lost your job and consequently lost your health care. We'd love to hear from you. Right now, though, we are joined in our studio by Dr. Stephen Chulgin, internist with Internal Medicine Associates and a consultant for the Central Valley Health Policy Institute in Fresno. Dr. Chulgin, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And we are also joined on the phone right now by Dr. Shana Alex Lavareda from the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research, the Director of Health Insurance Studies at the Institute. Dr. Lavareda, welcome.
Thank you.
We're talking about reform and the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. It passed a year ago. There are some elements of the law that have taken effect, although I think a lot of our listeners have heard in the media that the bulk of the law takes impact or becomes, in reality, the implementation of the measure in 2014. What is your instinct or what are you hearing from your patients, Dr. Chulgin, as far as are they aware of the measures that are being implemented right now as far as the Affordable Care Act?
There's a lot of confusion and because they've had a lot of misinformation. And so I don't think they could really tell you about the details of the Affordable Care Act if asked. There's a lot of misinformation. What it does do is in 2010, if you have a person 23 to 26 years of age, they can remain on their parents' plan. There is a federally funded high-risk pool for patients denied insurance because of pre-existing conditions, a tax credit for small employers to purchase coverage, and there is also a revamping of some insurance regulations that limits things like lifetime limits of coverage. There's some good things about it. But what people are focused on is, oh, my gosh, am I going to lose my doctor? Am I going to lose what I presently have?
And Dr. Lavareda, what's your reaction? What are you hearing from patients and individuals in the community as far as their knowledge of exactly the timeline of the implementation of the health care reform bill? Are they aware of the various measures that are out there and what California is doing to try to lead the way?
Not at all. I mean, the timeline is very complicated. I would like to expand on one thing that was just said. The expansion for young adults isn't necessarily just 23 to 26. It's actually an expansion for anyone 18 to 25, where you no longer have to be a student. So if you aren't planning on going to college, or if you are not currently enrolled in a college program and you're 19 years old, now you'll actually be able to get on your parents' health insurance, which you weren't able to do before. You used to have to be a student. So there is that. And that actually is the one provision that I think is most affecting people, and I'm hearing a lot of parents being very happy that they can put their 24-year-old who's graduated school back on their coverage, or their 20-year-old who took a year off back on their plans. But no, people aren't very aware of the timeline. We did have that big push in September of 2010, where lots of these provisions came into effect, along with everything else that was just said. Another big provision that came into effect was that preventive care is now free for anybody who's insured, and that is a big new thing, where you don't have to pay for your preventive services once your plan renews. But the other big provisions that are coming into effect, most of them are not happening until 2014, although there are some kind of behind-the-scenes changes that are happening now to get ready for 2014. And also California is a leader in that. We have this specific federal waiver for our Medicaid program, and we are going to be doing the expansion for adults on a county-by-county basis starting this year.
I understand that's the Bridge to Reform. Tell us exactly what that involves.
Well, this is a county measure, so it's not the federal government paying for the expansion as it will in 2014. But right now, counties are called the providers of last resort. So when you're an uninsured adult, you can go to these county clinics, and I do understand, as was mentioned in the report, that that is difficult for many people to want to do that. But at least that safety net is there, and then they have to provide care for you whether or not you're insured. So what's happening now is this waiver is allowing the counties to be able to use the money that they were using for these health care before and get that matched by the federal government by enrolling these people in Medi-Cal. And the Medi-Cal expansion is going to go all the way up to double the federal poverty level, which ends up being roughly $20,000 a year for one person, roughly $25,000 if you're two people in your family. And even if you're childless adults, so that means you don't have to have kids. You can actually do that, which is a new thing also for the Medicaid program. And so each county in California this year is having to sign up for this program, and it will be up to the counties whether or not they want to sign up for it, but certainly most are. And if there's public pressure in the county to do it, I think they certainly would. And then they're going to start getting this federal money to provide care for people and enroll people into Medicaid.
Now, Dr. LaVareda, are other states doing the same thing? I know California has made it clear that it wants to be a leader in terms of implementing this new law. Is this something that's happening nationwide? Are we one of a few pilot states that are leading this effort? How does California shape up with the rest of the nation?
Well, when it comes to the Medicaid expansion, we are certainly far ahead of anyone else. Other states do not have this federal waiver that we negotiated. We were kind of lucky in that our old federal waiver expired at the end of fall of last year, and so in the new federal waiver, they put in this Bridge to Reform to be able to, you know, put us on the path. We are definitely a bellwether and a leader in terms of the Medicaid expansion. In terms of the exchange also, which is another provision that's coming up in 2014, we are far and away ahead of other states in that we've already established the legislation for our exchange. We've established the board. There were a few states, though, that already had exchanges, like Utah and Massachusetts, and those states have existing exchanges. But in terms of states that were starting from the ground up, we certainly are well ahead of others.
Turning now to Dr. Chuljan, we heard the report from Modesto and the people in the North Valley who are experiencing not only the pains of the overall healthcare crisis that we have, but it's being that impact is being multiplied by the current economic crisis that we have. Certainly in the Valley, we already know, it's very well documented, that this region has been hit especially hard by the economy, and double-digit unemployment seems to be with us for some time for the immediate future. What are you seeing, Dr. Chuljan, as far as patients who are caught in the middle there? They may not be poor enough to qualify for certain programs currently, but They may have a pre-existing condition. Are they able to access something like the pre-existing condition insurance plan for California?
Well, this is my view on health care in general. You could provide lots of insurance, but if you don't have physicians, physician's assistants, community health clinics, if a patient doesn't have a medical home, you do not have good care. A person has to be able to identify someone as their physician or healthcare provider so that care can be coordinated, specialists are made available, prevention is done. There has to be continuity. And so if you visit the emergency room at St. Agnes Hospital, which is a hospital I work out of, it's loaded with people who are there without emergencies. They're there because they don't have a primary care physician. The pre-existing plan, the pre-existing insurance plan that is made available has restrictions anyway. You have to be a citizen. You have to be insured at least 6 months. You must have a pre-existing condition and denied health care coverage within the past 12 months. And so there are even conditions in dealing with that. So there may also be issues with regard to affordability and premiums. There was a resource where they estimated a 50-year-old's premium in San Francisco, a single individual. And it would estimated be at about $500 a month with a deductible of $1,500 in-network, $3,000 out-of-network, $500 deductible for medicines. That may still be unaffordable for some. When you look at the Health Care Reform Act, it's still going to leave a number of people uninsured even after full implementation. There's 7.5 million non-eldered uninsured in California. After implementation, there will still be 3.9 million.
And this is after 2014?
After 2014. This was based on a report by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation in analyzing the impact of Affordable Health Care Act on states. And that the statistics I gave you were specifically for California. So though there are benefits, it does not provide true universal care, and you're still going to have crowded emergency rooms.
If you just joined us on Quality of Life, we're talking about health care reform 1 year after the passage of the Affordable Care Act. While the act is being challenged in the courts by a number of states and others, the implementation of the act moves forward. However, that implementation is in many cases not enough for many Valley residents. We'd like to hear your story. If you're someone who has lost your health insurance in the midst of the economic downturn, the recession, if you've lost your job and thus lost your employment and the insurance provided by your employer, we'd love to hear from you. The phone number right now is 559-275-8989 or toll-free 1-800-224-8989. We're joined right now on the phone by Dr. Shana Alex-Lavareda from the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research, the Director of Health Insurance Studies. Now, Dr. Lavareda, one of the things that I've seen mentioned in the media recently is when we get to 2014, the current shortage of primary care physicians only gets worse. What are some of the solutions out there to address that issue and enhance care for individuals facing that?
Well, that's a really good question. I'm sorry, you're kind of going in and out. So I believe you just said primary care physician shortage in 2014.
Yes.
But that's a great question. But before I get to that, I do just want to mention in response to the numbers that were just cited by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, I mean, that survey, you know, is certainly a credible source, but, you know, the most up-to-date numbers are the ones that we just put out this last month from the California Health Interview Survey, which is a California-specific, it is the largest health survey in the country, and it's been used as a model nationwide for other state-based health surveys. Mm-hmm. The numbers are you know, stratified by county, and it's very California-specific, and we also are the only ones that really ask about citizenship status in a very detailed way.
So tell us
about
that.
And our estimates show that of the 7.1 million uninsured people in California, only about 1.1 million are going to be completely ineligible under health care reform. Everyone else will be eligible for something, whether it's the Medicaid expansion, whether it's the exchange with subsidies from the federal government, or whether they'll just get the benefits of the exchange even if they don't qualify for subsidies. So there is the possibility of increasing enrollment to try and get nearly all of the uninsured into something. And I do want to be optimistic on that front. But that does create more pressure on doctors. And there is this problem of primary care physician shortage, absolutely. The biggest problem of primary care physician shortage is not that the physicians don't exist. It's that they're not getting paid enough to want to see patients. So we have this problem with the Medicaid program where the reimbursements are so low that doctors can't afford to participate in the program. And those that do are able to do it as almost a charity care function. They do get some reimbursement, but it certainly doesn't even cover their costs. So that is the biggest problem. And the reimbursement rates are addressed in healthcare reform, where it mandates that the reimbursement rates be made higher under the Medicaid program to be able to account for this huge surge in enrollment that's coming up. Unfortunately, though, that's only for the first few years, and it's going to be paid for by the federal government. And so the state is very worried about, well, what happens after that? So that's still a point of contention. The point is that once we get everybody insured, that all of these clinics that have been operating on a free basis will actually be getting reimbursed for their services, and they'll be able to expand. Another issue is actually creating more of a workforce. And I think that the point was just made about we need physician assistants and nurses as well is an absolutely good one. And that's really where the shortages are in terms of even spots in schools for all the applicants who want to become nurses and physician assistants. And there is some money in this Health Care Reform Act to actually expand scholarships and to expand schools and placement programs for all people in terms of the healthcare workforce. So it's something that's being looked at as certainly a big issue. Whether or not we solve the problem, we'll have to see how it shakes out.
Dr. Chulchan?
Yes. I think that, very good points were made just there. But I really feel that the shortage is much more acute than just not getting paid enough to see Medi-Cal patients. That problem does exist. But even if you get the remuneration up to Medicare rates, there's still a number of physicians that aren't taking even Medicare patients. And when you consider an underserved region like Fresno County, there is a shortage of primary care physicians. Part of that is because we have historically paid more for procedural services than cognitive services. There has been much more emphasis on technology than there have been on preventative medicine and diagnosis. In addition, when an internist comes out of training, many of them go into hospital-based care and do not have private offices to see patients in an outpatient setting. Whereas over 20 years ago, anyone specializing in categorical internal medicine would have an office as well. So the system has changed where there are fewer people opening offices or manning clinics for outpatient care. It also takes a long time to train physicians, and that's not something that's going to happen by 2014. So I feel that the legislation does not address requirements for healthcare providers being in sufficient quantity to offer care to as many people as is projected.
Now, turning back to Dr. Lavareda right now, How much does the uncertainty of the future of the Affordable Care Act in terms of its status with the courts and its the various legal challenges to the law, does that create uncertainty in terms of planning for implementation of the act and some of these various state programs and other elements? We're going down to the county level. Does that complicate the process of implementation of the law?
In most states, it has not. Even the most of the governors that are part of the lawsuits are actually saying, we're part of this lawsuit, but we're going to act under the law right now, and we're going to implement. The interesting thing about the act is the law is that it does have a lot of flexibility, and so states are able to choose whether or not they want to implement, for example, the pre-existing condition program that was mentioned before that we chose to operate here in California, or if they just want the federal government to do it for them. So those governors that aren't acting to actually have their state make their own program, the federal government is still acting for those state residents. And so even if a governor says, well, I'm not going to create this program, then the federal government creates it for them. So the implementation is proceeding. And in terms of the legal challenges, there have been five court cases. Three judges have decided in favor of keeping the entire law in place. One judge decided that the individual mandate needed to be taken out, but everything else could remain. And one judge decided that the entire thing should be struck down as unconstitutional and you couldn't just take out the individual mandate. But that judge put a stay on his own decision that didn't block implementation. So the law is proceeding right now just on course, regardless of the court cases.
And that certainly will find its way to the United States Supreme Court at some point, I'm sure. Going back to the temporary high-risk pool, in California, the pre-existing condition insurance plan, as it's known, is that meeting its expectations in terms of the drafters of the law? Is it performing up to the expectation of its original intent in terms of acceptance from individuals signing up for that program? There have been some reports I've seen in the media where it hasn't had the adoption rate some expected.
No, and it is because the premiums are so high. It's all about the premiums. And the number that was quoted before, about $500 a month for a 50-year-old person who meets those requirements, the fact is, compared to the private market, that's a very good deal. Because if you were just going on the private market, if you were in your 50s with a pre-existing condition, you either wouldn't be able to get insurance offered to you at all, or it'd be offered to you at a rate of literally about $2,000 a month. So $500 a month is a great deal. But it's unaffordable. $500 a month is a big chunk out of somebody's income, especially when they've been laid off and when they have been uninsured for 6 months because they're not working. It's very difficult to meet that, and so enrollment has been very low. In 2014, under the exchanges, those subsidies that are going to be in place are not going to be based on whether or not it's a good deal compared to, you know, the private market without it. It's going to be based on a percentage of your income. So if your income is low and you get a subsidy under 400% of the poverty level, which translates to about $88,000 a year for a family of four, they're going to cap the premium at 8% of your income and then pay the rest, whatever that is. And so that'll do a lot to make it more affordable for people. But with these pre-existing condition pools, they just weren't able to do that yet. And no, the enrollment has not been nearly what they thought it would be.
Well, thank you very much for your insights today, Dr. Sheena Alex-Lavareda from the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research. She is the Director of Health Insurance Studies. Thank you so much for joining us today on Quality of Life.
Thank you. It was very interesting.
Thanks. We're going to turn back now to Dr. Chuljan, who is an internist with Internal Medicine Associates here in Fresno and is also a consultant to the Central Valley Health Policy Institute at California State University, Fresno. And before we go, I want to ask about this document, this report that you helped develop a few months ago called The Affordable Care Act and California's San Joaquin Valley, A Cause Perspective. What does this document outline and how did it come about?
The document came about as a result of a conversation I had with a patient who had concerns regarding health care. And it was a simple conversation that led me to say, you know, if I had some time, I would try to look at the problems and try to fix them. using my experience in the past 22 years of practicing medicine. And so the patient said, well, you know, if you can get together with someone, I'll back you up. And what happened is I ended up being introduced to Dr. Kapitman of the Central Valley Health Policy Institute. And for a year and a half before the Affordable Care Act was actually passed, we brainstormed a policy called CAUSE. And CAUSE stands for Continuous, Affordable, Universal, Sustainable, and Effective. And those are the principles that any successful healthcare reform needs to have. Well, in the midst of all this, the Affordable Care Act was passed. And so we developed a report analyzing its effect on the San Joaquin Valley, how it could be made better, and then what improved health care reform policy would look like. And that was published in October of 2010.
And this report, is it available for the public online? Or
it is. It's available online. www.cvhpi.org, and you will get the Central Valley Health Policy Institute website, and a banner will say CAUSE, and you click on the banner and you will be able to access the report.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Dr. Stephen Chulgin, MD, an internist with Internal Medicine Associates and a consultant to the Central Valley Health Policy Institute at Fresno State. We've been talking about the Affordable Care Act and implementing health care reform before the 2014 rollout of some of the major provisions of the law. This is Quality of Life. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment with the second part of our program. Every year, thousands of children wind up in emergency rooms with traumatic brain injuries sustained on the playing field in organized youth sports. We'll talk about what local educators and state lawmakers are doing to help reduce the dangers. Can youth sports be made safer? Join the discussion next on Quality of Life.
Have Muslims in America been radicalized? That's what a congressional committee will ask this week. Some think it's long overdue. Others say the hearing unfairly singles out one religious group.
That's the kind of thing that leads you to the Salem witch trials, the Inquisition, and frankly, McCarthyistic hearings.
Investigating who's responsible for homegrown terrorism today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered starts this afternoon at 4 on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Quality of Life comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. The unofficial start of spring finds the return of a number of familiar sights and sounds to the Central Valley. Green hillsides, orchards in bloom, warmer temperatures, and the distinctive sound of bat meeting ball at area baseball and softball diamonds. But this year, that sound may be a little different throughout the valley and the rest of the state as new regulations and a proposed law in Sacramento aim to make youth sports safer for student athletes. Last year, the California Interscholastic Federation adopted a rule mandating new bats designed to slow the speed of batted balls with the aim of reducing the risk of serious head injuries. Other newly adopted rules also call for reduced distance between the pitcher's rubber and home plate in softball, and also some new ideas about helmets as well. The rules are part of a larger effort to reduce the severity and number of brain injuries, not just in baseball and softball, but in all youth sports activities. Last December, Democratic Assemblywoman Mary Hayashi of Castro Valley introduced legislation that would require coaches to immediately remove students who suffer a head injury from competition and would prohibit their return until they're cleared by a medical professional. According to the Centers for Disease Control, each year, American emergency rooms treat 135,000 sports and recreation-related traumatic brain injuries, the vast majority of those, some 65%, occurring in children between the ages of 5 and 18. Here to tell us more about what's being done to protect children on the playing field or at the gym is one of the region's leading athletic trainers, Professor Scott Saylor, director of the Athletic Education Training Program at Fresno State. Dr. Saylor, welcome to Quality of Life.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
We are also joined on the phone right now by Ross Warren. He is a representative from the Assembly Business Professions and Consumer Protection Committee, chaired by Assemblymember Hayashi. Welcome to Quality of Life, Ross.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Ross, I'll start with you. Can you tell us a little more about AB 25, how it originated and what it calls for?
Well, it originated from Assemblymember Hayashi's experience in work in mental health issues. A lot of mental health issues are organic in nature, but they also can be external from sports injuries. So that's sort of what led to her interest in this particular bill.
And what exactly does the bill call for?
The bill expands on existing requirements with respect to prohibiting athletes from returning to play. Currently, this only applies to interscholastic sports. We want to expand that to include all school sports, regardless whether they're interscholastic or not. If you're organizing, at the junior high school level, sports competitions, football, baseball, or soccer, you know, some of the sports where concussions are somewhat regular, we want them to also comply with the requirement to have the parents be notified in advance of their children's participation of the signs and symptoms of concussion, and that they need to have a doctor's evaluation and note before the child can return to play if they've been suspected of suffering a concussion. We also are expanding this requirement to include any external sports activities that are taking place on the public school grounds. If you have a private organization that's renting the field, they would, with children playing, they also would have to comply with this.
And where does the bill stand right now? I understand it was introduced in December.
Yes. It will be heard sometime in the next month or so. The legislative process, it'll run through midsummer, and we hope to have it on the governor's desk in the fall and hopefully get a signature.
I should add, I forgot to mention, this March is National Brain Injury Awareness Month. So, again, thank you very much for joining us today, Mr. Warren. I want to turn now to Mr. Saylor, who joins us in our studio today. We think of head injuries in youth sports. I often think of a sport like football, but it's really a lot broader than just one sport.
You're exactly right. Brain injuries can occur in a variety of sports. We think of them in football because that's often the ones that we hear about. But sports like soccer and basketball and actually any sport that has the potential of hitting a solid object, that's obviously a risk factor for concussion.
Now, we're talking about the issue of youth sports in general, but specifically at the competitive level of high school sports, we see a lot of these injuries. And here to tell us a little more about what's being done on that front is Maria Ishida. She is the executive director of the California Interscholastic Federation. Ms. Ishida, are you with us today?
I am.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us on short notice on our program today. Tell us a little more about what the CIF, the California Interscholastic Federation, is doing to help reduce the risk of brain injuries in high school sports.
Well, last year, we our governing body, the Federated Council, passed a concussion policy and bylaw that Assemblymember Hayashi has patterned her legislation after. And basically, that is, if an athlete is taken out of a contest, any contest, and we're not just talking about football, they're taken out of a contest, they cannot come back in that day. They have to be seen by a licensed care provider and be released prior to coming back into the contest, even if there's a doctor on the sideline. Our medical doctors have advised us that trying to diagnose whether an athlete that has a concussion on the sideline isn't very conducive to that type of thing. And so they have recommended to us, and we've adopted that once you're taken out of a game or practice, you cannot come back in that day.
Again, if you just joined us on Quality of Life, we're talking about head injuries in youth sports. We'd like to know what you think. What can be done to make youth sports safer? The phone number is 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. Now, turning back to Ms. Ishida from the CIF in Sacramento, tell us a little more about some of the things that you're doing. This is a multifaceted approach, as I understand it. You have some regulations that go right down to the equipment level and also other things that you're talking about.
Most recently, last August, our governing body made the decision to go to the new bat standards this season, as opposed to waiting until next year when the rest of the nation is going to the new bat standards. So our governing body made the decision to go to the new bat standards this year. That's the BB Corps requirements that probably everybody's been hearing about. Plus, in addition to that, they made the recommendation that to our member schools that they consider advising or recommending to their student athletes, especially in particular baseball and softball athletes, that they wear some type of protective headgear when they're in the outfield or in the infield as a defensive player. So they made that recommendation. In addition, they made the recommendation for California to request that the National Federation, which is the governing body for all 51 state associations in the nation, to recommend to them that they start working with helmet manufacturers to develop standards for baseball and softball defensive equipment. And along that those lines, you probably just saw yesterday where Easton Bell Sports introduced a prototype that's out there for pitchers in particular, a protective helmet for them. So those are the other things that we've done to for the safety and welfare of our student athletes.
Scott, turning to you, how much of this is an education issue? Moving beyond the great advances that we can make in technology and equipment, how much of this is an education issue, talking to coaches, trainers, parents, others who are involved in youth sports?
Well, education is extremely important. What we need to do is make sure the parents are informed and the coaches are informed of the severity of these injuries. We're talking about anyone that's raised a teenager knows that the youth brain is in a state of flux that we can't really comprehend completely. And that's really the issue we're dealing with, is this developmental brain and it receiving a concussion. It just does not respond quite the same as it does when it's fully mature. And those effects can last with that child and can be devastating to that child even immediately and down the road.
Can you tell our listeners, maybe contrast what was done in the past years ago and how a brain injury, I think there's the colloquial term, someone got his bell rung.
Got your bell rung, right.
And contrast that with how someone is being treated today, a student athlete who's had a head injury.
Well, that was a big problem because in the past we didn't really have tools that looked at anything besides just really subjective information received from the patient. So do you have a headache, or are you nauseous, or are you having any visual problems? And some of that can be assessed, but some of it's very difficult to really get a true feedback from the student athlete because, you know, they're out there, they want to play. A lot of times their parents want them to play. Now we've moved to a situation where a lot of times we not only use that information that we collect from them, but we have them do a variety of cognitive tests, give them things like ask them to repeat the months of the year backwards, give them a series of words and have them repeat them to us throughout our assessment. Plus, at one point, a day or two later, we might use neurocognitive testing, which is a computer-based test which will assess how well they're functioning and how well they're actually able to use their brain. Very similar to any other injury, we would test that body structure before we put it back on the field. Now we're realizing how to do that with the brain.
There seems to be a lot more awareness of the dangers of sports-induced head injuries right now. I'm not sure if it's just a push by the major sports leagues like the NFL, et cetera, to bring this issue to the forefront. Is that the case? And number two, how do you filter this information out to the various school sites? And maybe this is also a question for Mrs. Shida from the CIF. Scott, I'll give you first shot at that.
Well, as far as awareness, I mean, there's obviously been some high-profile cases lately, but the NFL has really gotten behind this and really helped they have a goal of helping assist with development of legislation in a variety of states throughout the United States. So that's one thing that's really put a lot of it information out there. As far as making more people aware, we need to have better education of our public, but also making sure that they realize who they can access that has the information they need regarding concussions. And that's, you know, physicians that are trained in concussion management, other allied health professionals that are trained, athletic trainers. They're all potentially have a wealth of knowledge that can be beneficial in these situations in prevention and things like that. You know, the reality is we're not going to prevent all the head injuries. There's no helmet that can be made that can prevent that brain from shaking around in the skull. But if we can recognize the at-risk factors and then recognize those things that we can mitigate some of those factors, then we're making a little headway into helping some kids' lives.
Ms. Ishida, what is the process for distributing this information and the awareness out to the school sites and the various coaches and others who are interested parties, parents even? Is that something CIF is involved in?
Absolutely, and it's a huge undertaking because we have over 1,500 member schools, both public and private, and we estimate that any given year we have over 800,000 students participating in athletics. What we've done, the signs and symptoms of concussions is now part of the coaching education requirement certification that's required of all coaches. Plus, also up on our CIF State website, we have a couple of courses, free courses that parents can go on, coaches can go on and click on, and it takes them through some of the signs and symptoms of concussions. Because as talked about earlier, it's an educational process, and it's important that parents and coaches understand the signs and symptoms of concussions, and some of them can be very, very subtle. So we've got that accessible up on our website for anybody to go and learn about signs and symptoms. Plus, they also have then other areas where we've linked to, like the CDC, if they want more information on concussions.
If you just joined us on Quality of Life, we're talking about concussions in youth sports at the high school and even beyond level on Quality of Life today. We just heard from Marie Ishida. She's the executive director of the California Interscholastic Federation. We're also joined in our studio today by Scott Saylor. He is an associate professor at Fresno State and the program director for the Athletic Training Education Program. And we're talking about this issue of what's being done to try to make youth sports safer. Now, some of these sports are violent just to begin with. And there's been some discussion, I'm not sure if it's specifically on the youth sports level, but some discussion that, say, with football, you have players who are now wearing all this gear, shoulder pads and other gear, and then these helmets, hard surface helmets. To some extent, are we creating an environment where we almost create more injuries and making the game more violent? What are your thoughts in terms of the games themselves? Is there a way to maybe change the rules in some of these games to try to reduce concussions at the school level?
Well, we have definitely seen the rule changes have made a difference. Back in the 70s, we instituted spearing rules in football and saw a dramatic decrease in cervical spine injuries. We may be able to institute something similar, don't hit with the head, that type of thing in football. One of the leading authorities in sports concussion and mild traumatic brain injury, Dr. Robert Cantu, has come out recently and suggested potentially that we need to be practicing and playing without helmets, because there's a difference. You know, we're not seeing the same rate of concussion in sports like Australian rules football, rugby, because athletes don't have that protection. They're a little more cautious and a little more protective. They hit with larger parts of their body. They absorb the forces differently. And that what may be the answer is going back to what we used to do when we thought we were unsafe, leather helmets and things like that. I don't know if we're ready to move that direction, but that's got some validity.
Well, certainly an interesting thought, and we'd love to hear our listeners' perspective on this issue. What can be done to make youth sports safer? Is it just a technology issue, or should we look at changing rules for some of these sports that are quite familiar to many of us? The phone number, you can call us with your thoughts, 559-275-8989, or toll-free, 800-224-8989. Now, about a year ago, this particular issue in baseball, a sport that we don't normally think of as being prime risk for head injuries, it came to the forefront when last spring a young 16-year-old pitcher, Gunnar Sandberg of Marin Catholic High School, was hit in the head by a line drive, was in a medically induced coma for quite some time, had a portion of his skull removed, is now recovering, and turning to you, Ms. Ishida, I understand that he was involved yesterday with the release of this new concept for a new helmet for pitchers.
He was. He was at the press conference yesterday, and they have a prototype of a helmet for pitchers in particular. That's very lightweight. Obviously, they still have some work to do on it before it's released, but it's lightweight. It's unobtrusive. But it's designed specifically to that if a baseball is hit back at you, it glances off rather than hits you directly in the head. Gunner's X-ray showed that the fracture on his skull was the exact shape of the baseball that came right back at him. So yes, he was there. I was there. We're not necessarily advocating for the particular company that we were there for, other than the fact that we were there advocating for the development of safety helmets.
Shortly after that incident took place last year, there was a cry amongst some in the state to look at outlawing aluminum bats or composite bats and going back to wood bats. That hasn't occurred, but there have been changes. You mentioned the BB Corps standards. I'm not sure our listeners really know what that is, and I don't need to get into a scientific analysis of the materials, but what is the change that's been mandated in terms of the CIF?
The real change is, and it was the real change occurred because the purists of the game of baseball felt that the non-wood bats was changing the nature of the game, that we were having scores of 18 to 20 or 16 to 18 or things like that. And it was designed to bring back the game of baseball as we've known it. The baseball bats that have been used prior to this year in the state of California, people were able to alter those bats so that when the ball hit the bat, it had like a trampolining effect and came off the bat much, much faster, much quicker than a wood bat. So the design of the recommendation of the National Federation Baseball and Softball Committee was to go to some type of bat that acted more like wood bats. So thus the new BB Corps standards. The new bats are when the ball is hit off those bats don't have the trampolining effect as they had on the non-wood bats of the past, and they're designed more to act like a wooden bat. And so, anecdotally, what we've heard so far is that that's exactly what's happening out there, although what we're hearing is the new bats are kind of dead. Well, they've been designed to do exactly that.
Talking with Maria Ishida of the CIF, we now go to the phones and go to Nick in Fresno. Nick, you're on Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio.
Good morning.
Yes, go right ahead. Your question.
My question is one of financing with the California budget implying there are going to be a lot of cuts to education. How would that affect sports programs, and specifically, how would that affect the abilities of these school districts to pay for these new technologies? I think it complicates the issue, and I know it's not specific to the way that this discussion is framed this morning, but I think it is important to think about, and I will take my answer off the air.
Well, that's a very good question, Nick. Thank you very much for that call. And Scott, I'll turn to you. Do you know how are schools responding to this in terms of this is an era of severe budget crisis at many area schools? Is this something that's a hardship for these schools to put safety ahead of dollars or textbooks?
Well, I think you just couched it in the right terms. Is can we afford to have sports that if we can't afford to do them correctly? Now, purchasing all this new and improved and changed equipment, I can see that being a financial burden. A lot of the items that have been suggested are actually not fiscally don't have a fiscal impact. They're essentially fiscally neutral. In coaching education, incorporating concussion information into coaching education, parent education. We already do some of that regarding other types of injuries, but we need to ramp that up. There's lots of really good resources that have been put together out there that we just need to make parents aware of and student athletes aware of. So some of this that can make a big impact really doesn't cost any money at all.
And Maria, let me turn to you. And the question again is the budget crisis that's affecting so many schools right now, does that put a damper on efforts to adopt some of this new technology, these new bats, these new helmets? What's the impact at the school site level there?
Yeah, it is obviously a consideration. Our schools are in dire straits financially, as everyone is very much aware. And our governing body is very reluctant to make any type of decision that might impact our schools financially. However, when it comes to the health and safety of our student athletes, our governing body has been very quick to react and to respond, unlike other areas. But it is always a concern. We've got a number of schools now that are reducing their athletic programs. Coaches are losing their stipends, athletic directors are losing their periods off and also their stipends. So financial considerations do have an impact on our decision making, but not where health and safety of our student athletes come into play.
We have just a few minutes left. Scott, I want to turn to you. We've talked about educating coaches and parents. We've talked about new technologies, new types of helmets, new types of bats. What about communicating to the student athletes themselves? There's often a great deal of peer pressure and wanting to remain in the game or not wanting to wear that helmet that might look a little different than the regular baseball cap. How do you communicate the severity and the importance of this issue to a student athlete who just wants to go out there and win the game?
Well, in regards to sports safety, we really have to change the culture, because the culture is as long as you're on your feet, you can still play. One component that I'm a big advocate for is that athletic trainer. And not all schools have a certified athletic trainer, but an athletic trainer in that facility is a dedicated health professional that's actually looking at the athletic healthcare delivery system and looking at all the different components, the emergency action plans, the different aspects regarding the game and player safety, and is on site there ready to educate that athlete, educate the coaches. There actually is another assembly bill that's been introduced, AB 374, that speaks to that and actually tries to address obtaining services of athletic trainers in our public schools. The CIF is following a policy statement that was released last year from the American Academy of Neurology regarding these concussions, which is removal of the athlete or suspected of concussions from play until evaluated by a physician. And in their statement, the statement recommends that certified athletic trainer be present at sporting events, including practices where athletes are at risk for concussion.
Well, Scott, thank you very much for joining us today. That was Scott Saylor, Associate Professor and Program Director for the Athletic Training Education Program at Fresno State. And on the phone, Maria Shida. She's the Executive Director of the California Interscholastic Federation. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. That's all for today's program. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our Quality of Life podcast online at kvpr.org. And as always, we welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, producer Tracy Sharman, and production manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Quality of Life comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Kaiser Permanente, and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.